It's a great honor and pleasure to introduce Sarah Abravaya Stein. And you can see the title of her talk on the screen there, so I won't repeat it. Sarah is a 2015-2016 Guggenheim Fellow, Mazel Tov.
Thanks.
A professor of history and the Maurice Amato Chair in Sephardic Studies at UCLA. Her scholarship includes Saharan Jews and the Fate of French Algeria, Sephardic Lives, a documentary history, 1700-1750, which we taught last semester in our Everyday Jewish Life class, and a book I'm teaching this semester called Plumes, Ostrich Feathers, Jews, and a Lost World of Global Commerce. And you didn't even mention your first book, which is Making Jews Modern, which is about the Yiddish press and the Ladino press. So I use this line about Eric Gerber, I use it for Sarah Stein. So Sarah Stein has written how many books is it by now? But she's, I think it's four, is it four? But she's as modest as somebody who's only published three.
Thank you so much.
That's what I mean, you didn't put it on there.
Thank you for the invitation. Thanks to the hosts and the organizers. And I have to say, I think that you really only know that you're onto a good thing when people start arguing about a conference title. Then you think, yes, we've done it. We've tapped into some essential dynamic here. So I want to begin with what I thought would be a provocation, but in the context of the papers that have been presented so far, I think doesn't appear as such, which is that Sephardic studies is a fiction. An ironic provocation, perhaps, as we are here to discuss the state of the field, and even more so, perhaps, coming from someone who occupies a chair in that field. But nonetheless, I wanted to use my time first to demonstrate and then to argue that this field actually lacks a geographic or an ethnic or a sub-ethnic or a conceptual core, and in this that it is both as useless and as useful as the larger field of Jewish studies, of which it's a part, or maybe even Middle East studies. And I want to argue this, make this argument not abstractly, but in reference to a case study that's drawn from a book of mine that's coming out this year, which that's actually not the title of the book. It's called Extraterritorial Dreams, European Citizenship, Sephardi Jews in the Ottoman 20th Century. And my goal in the presentation is to both challenge and seek to expand the boundaries of Sephardic studies. And in so doing, as is now I think obvious since I'm the last speaker, I see myself not as a lone dissenter, but as operating in dialogue with recent scholarship and all those who are presenting here, and with so many colleagues on whose work my own builds. Why the shared fiction of our field remains useful, notwithstanding its fundamental slipperiness, is maybe a point I will return to in closing, or we can discuss in our closing discussion. So to my case study, which hopefully is not too richly dense. Last summer, in June of 2015, Spain granted citizenship to qualified applicants able to demonstrate descent from Jews expelled from 15th century Spain. And the policy evokes another passed a year earlier, which avails Portuguese citizenship to the descendants of Jews who fled the Inquisition and forced conversions of the 15th century Portugal. Both of these announcements pay tribute to their country's multicultural legacies, or attempt to, although similar policies towards Muslims have not been implemented. And Sephardic families in the United States, in Turkey, in Israel, and beyond have embraced the proposals, seeing Portuguese or Spanish citizenship as a shortcut to EU citizenship and a useful commodity, regardless of whether the individuals themselves intend to dwell on Portuguese or Spanish soil. Now, all of these actors, seemingly unbeknownst to them, are restaging a drama first enacted a century ago, if not earlier, when Portugal, Spain, along with Austro-Hungary, sought to actively register Sephardic Jews as subjects. Then, as now, public expressions of romantic intentions, both by the state and by Jewish applicants, provided a thin scrim for rather more strategic motives. In the first decades of the 20th century, as now, these governments viewed the acquisition of Sephardic subjects as materially and symbolically advantageous. And then, as now, state officials sought Jewish citizens to revive a faded global reputation and jumpstart a stagnant economy. So the pursuit of Sephardic Jewish subjects provides a metric by which to read and evaluate contemporary events, and contemporary events in turn suggest the enduring salience of a century-old story. So today I want to introduce you to my thinking about modern European, Ottoman, and Jewish history through the unique lens of extraterritoriality, by which I mean the story of individuals who were exempt from local law due to their protection by a foreign power. And this is at the heart of this forthcoming book of mine, which follows the early 20th century history of thousands of Sephardi women and men who were Ottoman born and usually Ottoman dwelling, but who were protégés, that is, extraterritorial subjects of European states. These were legally in between subjects, and they were extraterritorial, obviously. And in all of this, we're evocative of other liminal subjects of empire, translators, missionaries, midwives, native bureaucrats, all of whose histories in other fields have been used to complicate our understanding of the colonial arena. But if we take the metropolitan view, the kinds of subjects I'm interested in following, Ottoman-born Jews who were European by dint of their protected status, also helps us rethink what citizenship means from the metropole. And I borrow in this regard from historians of gender. In particular, I'll quote Laura Tabili, who is interested in, quote, the discrepancy between nationality as it was defined by states and citizenship as it took shape through local relations and daily life. So I'm motivated in this project, and then I'll turn to my case study, by three broad goals, which I think are relevant to our conversation about the state of Sephardic studies today. First, I'm interested in the complex entanglement of European and Ottoman histories. Secondly, I'm interested in intervening into the historiography of my own field, Jewish history, which has tended to treat citizenship flatly as something Jews either possessed or lacked. And has tended to understand the possession or lack of citizenship as a rough metric of a wide range of cultural, economic, or gendered practices. But this case study, by contrast, of Ottoman Jewish protégés and extraterritoriality as an institution, pushes us to consider citizenship as a spectrum, a range of conditions or positions that Jews could access rather than a single possession they could or could not claim. So the third point I want to make before launching into the case study actually relates to Aaron's presentation. I'm drawn to this theme of extraterritoriality in part because of its bedeviling amorphousness, because one could ask, where should one look for the history of legal misfits? And my third ambition is to reflect on the methodology behind this question. Seeking answers, my research has taken me to archives of various national and imperial polities, non-governmental organizations, global Jewish advocacy groups, as well as the living rooms of families with papers they were kind enough to share. And this very diffusion of material tells a story of its own. To think about extraterritoriality is to think in new ways about people and states and regions and the lines that demarcate them. And it's also to unthink the organizational schema that both archives tend to impose on the Jewish past and also institutional conceits like Sephardic studies tend to impose on the Jewish past, by which one could imagine a folder easily, naturally being labeled Jewish, which is a way, I think, which had actually traditionally guided some inquiries but does not guide this one. In any case, I have chosen to situate the piece of this story that I want to pull from the larger fabric today. I've chosen to situate us in the port city of Salonika, actually returning whence we began. For this was not only one of the most important ports of the Ottoman Empire at the turn of the century, or had been historically, but one of the few cities in Fantasiecle Europe which had very recently claimed a majority Jewish population. Salonika's Jewish community, like that of Ottoman Jewry as a whole, was overwhelmingly Sephardi, constituting, in this case, primarily Ladino or Judeo-Spanish speakers descended from Iberian Jewish exiles. And over five centuries, these Jews had become an integral element of Sephardic society, particularly in cities like Salonika, where Jews were densely concentrated. As Devin Narr has taught us, the city has had an almost fabled place in the Jewish world, in which it came to be known mythically and otherwise as the Jerusalem of the Balkans. And the loss of Salonika by the Ottomans to Greece in the course of the First World War, the Balkan Wars, heralded the end of an era for the city's Jews, as for Ottoman Jewry as a whole. And I have a couple of maps that Aaron and I published. No, this one is not. This one is of the region as a whole, showing you Salonika in the context of the region, and two maps that are drawn from Aaron and my, this map drawn from Aaron and my book, A Jewish Voice from Ottoman Salonika. So for centuries, many of the Jewish and the Armenian and the Greek merchants who lived in Salonika, as well as other trade centers of the empire, including dragomans, translators, and consular employees of the European powers, a large percentage of whom were Jews, existed as protected persons, or berat le, under a regime of capitulations that dated to the early modern period. Now, this history can be very intricately legalistic, and I will just try and briefly explain it to you here. It dates to a series of bilateral treaties that made up what is come to be known as the capitulations, signed between the Ottoman leadership and the European powers in the 16th century. And according to these treaties, rights were conferred upon European subjects who lived or conducted commerce in the Ottoman Empire, and including the protection of person, commerce, and property, and a degree of legal independence, especially the right to be judged in a consular court and not Ottoman Muslim ones. So reviewed and renewed by successive sultans, the capitulations allowed European and Ottoman officials to constantly and often with friction reevaluate their commercial and political relationship to one another. But meanwhile, this has been written about in the abstract by legal historians, by historians of macro historians of Ottoman or Ottoman European relations. But I'm interested in a micro story. I'm interested in the question of what happens as a consequence of these treaties to generations of Ottoman-born Jews and Christian merchants and their families who were extraterritorial subjects of Britain or France or Austro-Hungary or Portugal in time, despite never having lived in the polity in question. let's see. And so let me turn perhaps away from the legalistic conversation about the history of this relationship to the story of these individuals themselves. Now, the capitulatory regime can be mapped in a sense alongside the conflicts of the early 20th century, because it began to dissolve along with the fragmentation of the political entity which had birthed it, the Ottoman Empire. The peace treaties that followed the Balkan Wars dictated that the capitulations were to be abolished in territories and population and among populations annexed from the Ottoman Empire. And during the First World War, the Ottomans annul the capitulations. Various Ottoman successor states seek to override them. They are officially abolished in 1923 by the Treaty of Lausanne, but they live on in Egypt until 1949. But as I'm finding, even in Europe, the after effects of the capitulatory regime linger on in unexpected form, even modeling the fate of Ottoman Jewish ex-protégés who fell within the Nazi dragnet. Now, if we turn back to Salonika, what we find is that even as this old legal regime is crumbling in the course of the Balkan War, certain polities sense a void. And I'm interested now in the moment in the course of the Balkan Wars when Spain, Austro-Hungary, and Portugal, each in their own way aspirational empires, weakened empires and a young republic in the Portuguese case, sought to capitalize on the chaos in the Balkans in search of their own secure path in a nationalizing world. And as they looked to this great city of Salonika, a set of tantalizing questions arose for all of these states. What would become of all the Jewish merchants who stood to lose their protege status? Who would claim authority over them if Salonika was lost to the Ottoman Empire? Who would have the right to impose taxes on them? Who might benefit from a relationship with this mercantile class? And what happens, indeed, is there is a gap. During the uncertain months between the Greek occupation of Ottoman Salonika, October 1912, and the formal designation of the city as Greek, 1913, so it's less than a year of a gap. These consulates that I'm describing, Portugal, Spain, Austro-Hungary, come in and seek to recast a faded legal category to their advantage, with the hope of enticing, as protégés, the single largest Jewish mercantile population in southeastern Europe. And the timing is cruelly auspicious. During the Balkan Wars, the 75 to 80,000 Jews of Salonika had witnessed a rash of anti-Muslim violence and anti-Jewish violence and anticipated a decline in their city's economic vitality. Many Salonikan Jews were trepidatious about the possibility that anti-Semitism would rise with the acquisition of Salonika by Greece. Jewish emigration from the city begins to skyrocket, and those who stay behind begin to gravitate towards novel forms of politics. And at the same time, several thousand Jewish women and men rush to acquire the protege status, hopeful that these papers will provide them a measure of political security in a world turned upside down. What is interesting is that from the state's perspective, the acquisition of Jews, of Sephardic Jews, serves as a vehicle of colonial ambition. And the exact mechanism of colonial ambition is different for the Spanish and the Portuguese and the Austro-Hungarian, and maybe I won't go into each in depth, but in Spain, there is a newfound interest in restoring the commercial and cultural, might that had been lost when Spain relinquished its remaining overseas empires in 1898. And according to this vision, Sephardic Jews could be a key, essential assets of an aspirational nation. And this takes form in Salonika. Spanish representatives come, a consul comes, promising to extend Spanish protection to Jews in Salonika who, quote, spoke Spanish, were of Spanish origin, whom modern Spain recognized as her sons. By the end of 1913, just the Spanish consul in Salonika had registered 175 Spanish Salonican Jewish men representing their entire families, roughly 850 souls. And at the same time, the Austro-Hungarian Empire has its own motives and actions. Their ambition was to finally secure the right to connect Vienna to Salonika by railroad, affording the empire access to the Aegean Sea and the promise of greater economic influence in the Balkans. They were afraid that if Salonika fell to Greek or Bulgarian hands, they would lose this right, and imagined then that Jewish merchants in the city would be their conduit to a commercial future. And therefore we see a rash of Jews who turned to the Austro-Hungarian consulate, also offering papers to Spanish Jews in this city, including this really interesting doctored passport by so-called, his name is Chaim Jacob Amir, but his Ottoman passport is doctored in his application to the Austro-Hungarians such that he adds a new name, Felix. So suddenly, Chaim Jacob Amir becomes Felix Amir to show his ever-present desire to be Austro-Hungarian. At the same time, we have Portugal in the mix. Portugal now at this time is vetting a proposal to allow the massive settlement of East European Jews in Angola, hoping, and this plan is widely covered in the Ladino and French language press of Southeastern Europe, the idea for Portugal was that an influx of Eastern European Jewish immigrants to its colonial possession would provide Portugal a middle-class white settler population to further its colonial ambitions. The proposal is embraced by the Portuguese parliament. It is ratified. But even before it is passed, in Salonika, the press starts saying, this is so wonderful, Portugal promises us a home and citizenship. and Portugal's representatives in this Salonika and also in Istanbul seize on the opportunity and begin registering Ottoman-born Jews as Portuguese subjects, including, for example, Eli Condoy, the Portuguese vice consul in Damascus, and his son. And at roughly this, and I think this is an example of Portuguese registrations of Isaac Beja during this time. At the same time, Portugal's honorary consul in Salonika begins registering Salonican Jews as Portuguese, including the papers that you see here. Early 1913, the Portuguese consul in Salonika is arguing for the systematic addition of Salonican Jews to Portugal's registration books, not simply as protégés, but as citizens. The foreign minister encourages these actions, but suggests that Jews in Salonika should be granted provisional registration. Provisional registration being a fruitfully vague strategy designed to reap Portugal potential benefit without incurring any obligation. So in Salonika, the Portuguese consul, himself a Jew, Portuguese Jew, registers 500 Jewish families as Portuguese subjects. So vigorous were his efforts that he's actually obliged to buy new printing presses simply to produce enough passports in time. And he manages to acquire such beautiful printing presses. According to one observer, they produced passports that were, quote, magnificent in comparison with those of other consulates. None were really aware of it at the time, but what happened is that the consul's very zeal in producing passports would provoke decades of consternation for both paper holders and Portuguese state officials, because the passports were so handsome that a temporary paper could easily be mistaken for citizenship. And the consequences are actually quite grave. I'll get to that later. So what does all of this mean? What does it mean for a Sephardic Jew to be pursued as the subject of a foreign power? What does it mean, in the case of the Portuguese particularly, to acquire or grant provisional protection? By acquiring one's name to the registration books of Portugal, was one acquiring citizenship? Could provisional status become permanent? How far could protection pass? Beyond the traditional vector of husband to wife or father to child, could it travel between siblings, from son to mother, or by a deceased husband to his widow? In the aftermath of the Balkan Wars, Jewish holders of papers and European officials answer these questions variously. And even the Portuguese foreign minister's own opinion shifts radically over time, creating a great deal of consternation for individuals and families who hold or desire these papers or have them taken away. Certain Jewish families who are registered in 1913, unsure of the value of the papers they have, find themselves now committed to a decades-long dance with officials. And I'll give you just one example. There are so many. The example of the de Botton family. During the Greek occupation of Salonika, Meir de Botton and at least 11 of his children registered in Salonika as Portuguese subjects. Over subsequent years and migrations, the family leveraged their registrations to claim other forms of official recognition. So Meir de Botton's children and four of their spouses were granted Portuguese passports, which they weren't entitled to by the law because they were just supposed to be provisionally protected. Four were granted Portuguese passports from Istanbul, Milan, Barcelona, and Rio de Janeiro. I mean, really, this is because they were so pretty. The papers they had were so pretty. No one could believe they were temporary. Truly, this is all in recorded both from the perspective of state officials and the individual Jews. Another brother obtained citizenship from the consul in Rome for his new wife, a French citizen who had been denaturalized. All told, the de Botons appealed to no fewer than seven Portuguese consuls over a period of 2 decades. Now, questions of gender complicate the meaning of provisional registration still further, emphasizing its shifting value. Portugal's consulates employed a spectrum of strategies for registering women, children, and families. Some chose to list only men in the registration papers, presumably assuming that unidentified dependents would automatically inherit their husband's or father's legal status. In other instances, women and children were listed as dependents of husbands and fathers, or in the case of widows, sons. sharing a single registration number and documentation. And that's what you're seeing here, that this is registration for the patriarch of the family, but his wife is listed. Other consular representatives registered women and children as discrete subjects, granting them separate entry and registration numbers in the relevant ledgers. But nor were women treated in a static fashion throughout their lives. In 1929, the Portuguese consulate in Athens issued Rebecca Benveniste, a native of Salonika, her own travel papers. These documents, which were heavily used, you see them here, featured a photograph of the young woman with her son Jacques and bore no mention of her husband Vital. However, 10 years later, the family was issued a group passport, again from Athens, under Vital's name. So Rebecca and her children had become dependents. For women, it seems, documentary independence could be reevaluated and even constricted over time, according to the whim of an individual bureaucrat. So these cases suggest that Jewish women and children face their own layers of uncertainty as they sought, carried, renewed Portuguese protection. And to be a dependent of a provisionally protected person was really to skate at the outer limits of citizenship. Now these dynamics grew even more complex after the Greek annexation of Salonika, when Greeks commenced a Hellenizing effort in the city. And many others have talked about this Hellenizing effort, so I won't go into detail, but I want to say that one of the things they did was to try and restrict the number of foreign protected subjects in their midst. And now we have the Portuguese consul, the Spanish consul, the Austro-Hungarian consul, all complaining that their subjects were being taken away. And Jewish holders of foreign papers were also jockeying for insurance. Chaim Perez and his son Levi Perez both had been provisionally registered by the Portuguese some months earlier. They're threatened with the removal of their paperwork, and they protest this. Other Jewish families who were granted foreign papers took on Greek citizenship, whether by desire or out of pressure, I don't know. Now, with the onset of the First World War, the limits of extraterritoriality are tested even further. Greece enters the conflict. Conscription is imposed on Greek men of fighting age, including holders of foreign protection. Foreign consulates in Salonika are incensed and complain. And across the Sephardic Jewish diaspora, Jews scramble to local consulates, trying to understand what responsibilities they had to their protector state or to the Greek state. And the answers are rarely clear. Across Europe, on both sides of the conflict, the First World War means that passports, residency permits, and official papers are more necessary than ever, especially to extraterritorial subjects, refugees, and the stateless, which are really very different categories, whose numbers are growing with every year of the conflict. Jewish protégés from Salonika confounded protector nations all over the world, wherever they went to their local consulate, in great part because they were what we might call doubly extraterritorial. So these people had acquired Portuguese protection without ever leaving their home, the Salonican Jews. And they traveled with Portuguese or other forms of protection. But when they went to local consulates in Rio, let's say, they were not only subjects living outside their protector nation, so they were holders of Portuguese papers, not living in Portugal, but they were also outside of the social and legal framework of Salonika, which had justified their acquisition of foreign protection. These were produced all sorts of ironies that Portuguese and other European officials around the world were ill-prepared to make sense of. This meant for some, provisional protection morphed into citizenship. For others, they lost their papers, therefore becoming stateless. Now, global politics are influencing the nature of citizenship, but it's an event in Salonika that gives Portugal in particular the chance to harden its policies towards Sephardic Jews. There is a massive fire in 1917 in the city, wrecking catastrophic damage to the historic center of Salonika. 52,000 Jews are left homeless, along with 10,000 Muslim and 10 to 15,000 Christian residents of the city. 32 synagogues are burned, 9 rabbinical libraries, countless private libraries, archives, and schools. And like so much else, the Portuguese consulate in Salonika burns. And with it is obliterated all the registration of Ottoman-born Jews who had been labeled Portuguese subjects. So as news of this ripples across the Salonican Jewish diaspora, people begin to panic because they realize that the documentation that has granted them papers, which has in many cases allowed them to emigrate to new places, has all been destroyed. And again, we have a wave of Jews. They are Ottoman, they were never Greek, but they were born in a city that is now Greek, are going to consulates in London, in Manchester, I mean, you name any city in the world, seeking to renew their papers or confirm their status as citizens or protected people. The Portuguese consul in Rio complained to the foreign minister with evident exasperation, quote, Jews from Salonika holding Portuguese passports and visas from Portuguese consulates in Europe, which have been verified by the foreign minister, continue to present themselves at this and other consulates in Brazil. Witnessing this demand for papers, the foreign ministry, and I'm just, again, teasing out the Portuguese case, we could talk about anyone, begins an inquiry. What the hell is going on? How did this happen? Because we never promised citizenship. Why do these people think they have it? They begin an inquiry, and they conclude that the practices that had been implemented in Salonika were irregular. And they announce that all future registrations were to adhere to Portuguese nationality laws, and anyone granted this strange category of provisional protected person papers, their papers would be considered null and void. And this is followed by a yet more draconian crackdown some years later by an auditor. I never even knew the category of consular auditor existed until I started doing this research, but it does. An auditor is hired. The auditor combs through the Portuguese ledgers. His goal is not explicitly to ferret out Jewish holders of Portuguese passports, but he concentrates his energies on consulates, which had granted papers to Jews in disproportionate numbers, not only Salonika, but also Vienna, Istanbul, Athens, Naples, Cairo, Alexandria, Tunis, and Casablanca. And he is particularly interested in what unfolded in Salonika. He concludes that these registrations were, quote, certainly illegal in the juridical sense, as these naturalized persons claim a vague and very doubtful Portuguese genealogy, and he too proposes that all such registrations should be null and void. Now, in the short term, this means that many people lose their papers, but these outcomes lay a foundation for an inflexible policy towards Sephardic refugees who seek Portuguese papers in the course of the Second World War, including some whose families actually held provisional Portuguese protection at an earlier time. Now, Portugal does open its door to Jewish refugees during the war, and Salazar's administration, in fact, grants entry to Portugal to Jews from Vichy, France. But it resists coming to aid of Jews in Greece until nearly the war's end. And in so doing, the prime minister is exhibiting a greater tolerance for Jews who had no historical relationship to Portugal than he showed to those who had once been embraced by the Portuguese state. And I should say this happens despite the fact that Germany notifies Portuguese authorities before it deports Jews, including those this family pictured here, before it deports Jews from Greece and Italy to the death camps, and granting Salazar the opportunity to repatriate these Jewish holders of Portuguese papers. But in virtually all instances, that is not, this has a complicated history I'm not going into, but in many instances, that is not pursued. So here is what I've attempted to describe here, and I'll turn to close and see if there's time for conversation. In the middle of the Balkan Wars, middle and upper class Jews in Salonika are sought as protégés by a number of countries, including Portugal, to bolster their economic growth, to fulfill an imperial fantasy, to develop desirable markets in new countries. Tellingly, these states did not pursue Sephardic Jews outside Salonika as aggressively as it did inside Salonika. Nor at this time as today, were they as interested in Muslims? Maybe they were as interested in Christians, but as they were in Jews. To Portuguese state officials, Sephardic Jews were particularly seductive subjects. They were would-be settlers. They were ersatz compradors. To the Sephardi Jews who pursued these forms of protection, what these papers offered was a hedge against an uncertain world, an old form of insurance that might provide a buffer against a new and calamitous century. Now, in the case of Portugal, the protection that I'm describing is ambiguous because of its provisional nature, and these very ambiguities produced it decades of conflicting perspectives. And it is those conflicting perspectives that in this book project I'm calling extraterritorial dreams, varying interpretations of law and policy that were all the more confounding in times of war, threat, and hopeful expansion. Jewish protected subjects of Portugal were both privileged and endangered by their status, even more because of the provisional nature of their protection. But what perhaps interests me the most about this inquiry is that over the course of the late 19th and early 20th century, citizenship was, for many Ottoman-born Jews and their diasporic-born dependents, as much a matter of perspective as a matter of law. Local consular officials, police representatives, and government bureaucrats didn't always understand or choose to follow foreign ministry directives, and these changed over time. And they didn't always implement these directives in a straightforward manner. And holders of protection, meanwhile, realized through experience that papers could be leveraged and even in certain cases transformed into citizenship, notwithstanding laws to the contrary. Alternatively, protection could vanish altogether. In the absence of strict and coherent rules, clear directives, or fixed ambitions on the part of the states involved, protection was a malleable entity shaped by the competing desires of the parties involved. Now, I might have actually already used my last minute, but I'm going to claim that I have another minute and ask what insights this brief tour of the history of Jewish extraterritoriality lends us as we reflect on the current state of Sephardic studies today. I think it points principally to the tremendous elasticity of our subject matter. It is not enough to say that Sephardim lived across a tremendously varied geographic and political terrain, which they did, nor is it enough to say that we use this term lazily, which we do, to encompass diverse groups whose histories do not easily align, and also because sometimes we use this term to suggest there were rigid boundaries around this so-called community, which of course there weren't. There were no boundaries that clearly delineated Sephardim from Ashkenazim or from the other Jews they lived alongside, just as in many contexts the lines were blurry, which divided or in fact didn't divide Jews from non-Jews. Now, all of this has been effectively argued by other people already and by me already. What I'm really more interested in foregrounding today is something new. That is the historical importance of self-invention and reinvention. The ability of individuals, women, men, families, to recast themselves, to relabel themselves, not through emigration, which we would expect, but by strategically navigating or even manipulating existing legal options, exploiting loopholes, and exploring opportunities to transform their official status. This conclusion flies in the face of what we thought we knew about modern Jews' relationship to citizenship. It's not something you have or you don't have. It's not something that necessarily you are granted or denied. Here a new picture emerges, legal identity as fiction, myth, as a spectrum on which one can travel. Sephardic Jews of the early 20th century then knew something that we still struggle to comprehend. Ottoman, European, Sephardic, Ashkenazi, these are not rigid categories of identity or even of politics or geography. Similarly, far be it from me to argue that the rubric of Sephardic studies has outlived its usefulness. That's really not my intention. But recent scholarship in the field is at its best, I think, when it does not assume the solidity of its subjects' boundaries. How much more true if we set out to move as we have today, to move across the boundary of North Africa, the Maghreb, the Mashriq, Iran, Southeastern Europe. I think that, pushing ourselves to identify that which is most slippery about the field that we inhabit will in fact allow us to denaturalize our subject, and here I really build on Aaron's talk, to denaturalize our subject and make it all the more interesting. And rejecting the categories we have inherited offers us one other possibility as well, which is to look in new places for the histories of our subjects. And part of what I think I'm trying to show you, both through the visuals here and through the talk itself, is not only a lesson about the nature of legal identity, nor a lesson about the very amorphousness of Sephardic culture, but a lesson about where one looks for the Sephardic past. And the conclusion I offer is that the more one looks in untraditional and even non-Jewish spaces, the more the story one produces can change. So, thank you.
So I have a proposal, which is that we go right into the closing session. Maybe you could take one or two questions,
you
and
wish.
Then I'll turn it over to Fred. So I see Rita and Ezra.
I thought it was really wonderful, and the complexity and nuanced view of the subject, and how you use the very specific examples to illuminate it. It was really very exciting.
Well, thank you.
I would only just say that in the American context, the issue of who a natural-born citizen is, given the Republican candidates, is still, it doesn't seem to be settled well.
Exactly. These are still burning issues. Yeah.
Hi, thank you for sharing such exciting research. I had two questions quickly. One was, I'd be interested in hearing more about the gender lines of citizenship, questions of transference. Was that a means of regulating families? Did it effectively regulate kinship formation through this process of citizenship? And the second part is responding to your insight at the end about looking not at immigration and diaspora, but towards internal manipulation of the papers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking in a comparative sense about what was happening in exactly the same period in Ashkenazi history, how there was such a critique of citizenship articulated through the immigrant experience in North America, especially Russian anarchist movement being developed out of the immigration. And so I'm curious what might be the implications for how they were theorizing citizenship as something to be aspired towards, but not about borders.
Well, that's certainly more than I can answer well now, because that's a lot of rich lines of inquiry, and I don't want to bleed into our next our open conversation time. But I'll try and give myself 60 seconds and look at the clock here and see how I do. I mean, on the theme of gender, it's fascinating because despite the fact that there are supposed to be policies and standards in place, there aren't. And that's so. It's to me, it's interesting commentary about the state. The state thinks it knows what it's going to do, but state representatives do other things. And people, individuals, women and men and families know this. So one of the things I kept looking for was the way that individual Jews would write applications with what they thought the official wanted to hear, and all sorts of wonderful things emerge. They invent categories for themselves that are patently untrue. They talk about sort of founding familial myths that are patently untrue. So there's no rule about what happens to women. There's a myriad, and I go into this in a lot more detail. But that in itself is really interesting, that the confused experience of women reflects a larger confused experience. What was the second question you asked about?
Oh, just thinking, just shifting.
Oh, the Ashkenazi. Okay,
yeah,
the Ashkenazi. Right. So it's really more than I can do justice to, but one of the things I think it's really important to point out is that at this precisely the time I'm exploring, there are Eastern European Jewish refugees, there are Eastern European Jewish stateless people, and there are Eastern European Jews pursuing new forms of legal identification which classifies them as the stateless, like the Nansen passport. Some Ottoman Jews become refugees. Some Ottoman Jews become stateless. A very few Ottoman Jews seem to get the Nansen passports. But what's different is the history of the capitulations. And this whole realm of the protected person doesn't have an equivalent in the Ashkenazi world. So in that sense, this is a distinctly Sephardic story, which allows us to challenge the global narrative we tell about modern Jewish emancipation, which I think is totally flawed, not only because it's never been interested in women, which it hasn't. I mean, a little bit it has, but not very well, but also because it's totally European in its focus. Aaron said this earlier too. So that's a stab, there's more to say. But I want to turn over the table.
Well, I think Fred might have some responses
okay.
to you too.
Great.
So why don't I introduce Fred? If people want to take, should we take 1 minute, maybe? Okay, let's take 1 minute. But don't go anywhere, sir, because we're going to keep talking about it. Thank you so much.